There was never any way Jack Smith was going to be able to investigate, indict, deal with the immunity issue, which was definitely headed to the Supreme Court, and try these cases before 2 years, before the November 24 election. And sure enough, he did not get either of them in before the election. Trump wins, and that's the end.
Ellie, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, happy to be with you, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
So you've written an excellent new book on the history of special counsels. Can you start by explaining who are special counsels? What are they?
Well,
what do they do?
They've had different names over the years, independent counsel, special prosecutor, now special counsel. But essentially, this is what happens when DOJ has an investigation of typically the president, but it doesn't have to be the president. But any investigation that poses such a serious conflict of interest or extraordinary circumstance. So I would classify everything from Watergate to Iran-Contra to Clinton and Ken Starr up through the recent cases, Robert Mueller and Jack Smith and the Joe Biden investigations. All of those are some variation of this creation.
And the concept has been around for a long, long time. You write about Grant,
yeah,
right?
I didn't actually know when the first one of these was. And I've heard people say Teapot Dome, which I kind of remember from like sophomore year history.
From AP US history.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it's actually, that's not true. That was in the early 1900s. Ulysses S. Grant in the 1870s. And the thing I love about this story is it's so many of its echoes continue today. So Grant basically was under pressure because these tax collectors were taking kickbacks from whiskey distillers in Missouri, of course, because it was the 1870s. Someone brings this to Grant's attention. He says, well, let's bring in an outsider. The outsider starts getting close, starts indicting sort of low-level people. But then he gets close to one of Grant's, basically Grant's right-hand man. And Grant tries to fire the guy. Grant says, let's have the military take over. The guy ends up getting fired. The media attacks Grant. Grant says he's being targeted by the media. I mean, you can see the echoes of this through the decades and centuries.
And almost a century later, the office of the special counsel was created, right?
Yeah. So the office of independent counsel was created after Watergate. It may be easy to forget, but there were no rules in place. When the Watergate investigation happened, there was no set of laws. John Dean, who I spoke with, who's a friend of mine, said it was all ad libbed. I talked to a couple of the Watergate prosecutors. They said, we did our best, but we didn't have guidelines and protections. After Watergate, in 1978, because of Watergate, Congress passes this law and we get the system that existed until the late 90s. But that essentially died because everyone hated what happened with Clinton and Ken Starr both ways.
And the first case after that came into law involved cocaine in Studio 54.
I mean, it couldn't be more disco era, right? The very first, the case everyone remembers is Clinton and Starr in the 90s. But the first one was in the late 70s. And yeah, there was a guy named Hamilton Jordan, spelled Jordan, but I learned doing my audiobook, it's pronounced Jordan, who was the chief of staff in the White House, was accused of sniffing cocaine, snorting cocaine at Studio 54. And I quote the tape recording they made of the dealer, who's basically like, I think I gave some guy a toot. And it's like, yeah, they're not prosecuting that. But very late 70s, that was declined to prosecute. And, you know, at that point, it seemed like everything would be smooth sailing. Hey, the system works. But of course, it got more complicated after that.
It got especially complicated with Ken Starr. So can you talk about his impact on ultimately killing the special counsel law?
Yeah, I think Ken Starr is largely, maybe not solely, there were a couple other 90s cases that went really bad, but he was the primary reason that the law died. I talked for this book to David Kendall, who represented, and I think still to this day represents the Clintons, Lanny Brewer, who was a White House lawyer at the time defending Clinton White House, and Saul Weisenberg. Ken Starr passed away a few years ago, but Saul Weisenberg was Ken Starr's basically number two. And, you know, Kendall tells me about this moment when, remember, this had been just Whitewater, just these land deals and stuff for three, four years. And Starr looked like he was packing up his boxes. And then the Monica Lewinsky thing drops. And so one night, this story's in the book, Kendall gets a call from the White House press secretary. He says, emergency phone call tonight, 9 p.m. The Monica Lewinsky story is about to drop. And Kendall says, who the heck is Monica Lewinsky? And now he finds out, okay, there's this allegation. The Washington Post is going to run a story. Kendall then calls DOJ, calls Eric Holder, who at the time was the number two person at the Justice Department, and says, Eric, this is a mistake. Like, this can't be within Ken Starr's purview. He's just looking at these land deals, not this intern thing. And he said Holder was at a Wizards basketball game, and Holder sort of stepped out into the you know, the private area and goes, yeah, David, I wouldn't get too far out ahead of that one. So at that point, he knew, you know, the case at that point just blew up and went off the rails. I will tell you one of my favorite details. Saul Weisenberg, who I interviewed, is the lawyer who asked Bill Clinton the question that resulted in the answer, "It depends on what the meaning of is." I know you remember that, right?
Yeah, probably the most famous quote.
Right. So yeah. I said, what did you think when you got that answer? And he says to me something like, you know, I got to be honest with you. Up to that point, Clinton was kicking our ass. Like, we didn't get anything out of him. But when he gave that ridiculous response with the look on his face of like that sort of half smile, he said, I knew that would be the only thing people would remember.
How close did Ken Starr get to actually indicting Bill Clinton?
So it's a great question. He could not have indicted Bill Clinton because longstanding DOJ policy says you can't indict the sitting president. However, a guy named Bob Ray takes over after the impeachment and finishes out the last year or so for Ken Starr. I interviewed Bob Ray for this book and I asked him exactly that question. He didn't quite say we definitely would have indicted Clinton, but he said to me essentially, I would have if I had to. He said all the pieces were in place. And there's this dramatic meeting that happens Christmas Eve or so, not exactly, but, you know, Christmas season of Clinton's last year. He's got 3 weeks left in office. It's Christmas of 2020. And Bob Ray says, I need to meet with the president face to face. And so he gets sort of smug.
Oh, 2000, not 2020, 2000.
What did I say? Yeah, 2000. Yes, 2000. Correct. Bob Ray gets basically smuggled into the White House map room. He sits across the table from Bill Clinton. There's lawyers there. And Bob Ray basically just says to him, look, I need you to issue a public statement admitting what you did, pay a fine, and give up your bar license. And if you do that, we're done. And Clinton, on the last day of his presidency, January of 01, announced, you know, it's announced that they've reached this deal. And, you know, I said to Bob Ray, what if Clinton hadn't agreed to that? What if he said, get the hell out of here? I'm not agreeing to anything. Bob Ray basically 90% of the way told me I would have indicted him. And I said, are you nuts? You would have in 2001 in D.C., you would have lost. That jury would have come back in 6 minutes saying not guilty. And he goes, maybe. Yeah, you're probably right. But if I felt like I had to, I would have done it.
You also spoke to numerous people involved in Bob Mueller's investigation. What did you learn about their frustrations? Obviously, Bob Mueller did not indict Trump.
Yeah, you know, there were some frustrations on the team. I mean, look, all the team members deeply admire Bob Mueller, as do I. I don't know him, but I mean, the guy is a Purple Heart recipient. He was wounded in combat in Vietnam. He went back. He could have gone home and he chose to go back. I believe he's, and I say this in the book, I'm pretty sure he's the only person in American history nominated to different positions by four different presidents of both parties, two and two, confirmed by the Senate unanimously every time. So this guy's a hero. But when it came for his special counsel case, the big controversy was he never said his conclusion, right? He said, I find no conspiracy to collude with Russia, but I'm not going to say whether I find obstruction because I'm not allowed to indict the president. So it's not fair for me to say. That became very controversial. Democrats hated that he did that. They felt like he pulled up short. The team members said, look, he was within his rights to do that. Some of them said, do we wish he had been more clear, more definitive? Yeah. One of them said to me something like, did I have daydreams about calling a press conference and just running downstairs and saying, here's what we really found? Yeah. But the defense of Mueller is that he was an institutionalist and he wasn't going to go out and make public accusations that the sitting president had committed a crime when there was no way for the president to defend him. I mean, of course, Donald Trump is capable of defending himself, but not through a trial, not through the formal means of a trial. So that's come under a lot of criticism. I actually spoke to one of the people who drafted the regulations, which say the special counsel, Mueller, or whoever, is supposed to state their prosecution or declination decisions. And I said, given that, do you think that Mueller should have said what he concluded, like should be indicted or not? And this guy, Mark Toohey, said, yeah, I do. I did think Mueller was supposed to say what he found, whether he found it was a crime or not. And Rod Rosenstein said the same thing. So, look, there's a fair debate to be had there about whether Mueller was too cautious or sort of did the right thing in terms of larger institutional principles.
And looking at Trump 2.0, it's kind of a miracle that he didn't fire Mueller in the first term. But you do write about how Mueller's investigators, I think, backed up their files.
Yeah, off-site. Yeah. So it is a miracle. And I think I use that term in the book. I said, looking back now, can you believe and could you envision the current Donald Trump allowing a special counsel to
would
be
never happen?
Yeah. I mean, it would never happen. It would be stopped immediately. And that person would be sued and fired and maybe charged criminally themselves. But yeah, there's a great, again, historical echo here. Jill Wine Banks, one of the Watergate prosecutors, told me that she and others used to take home evidence. They would not originals, but photocopies of key documents and key witness statements. And because they were afraid that Nixon's goons were going to just seize the office. There's a great moment where, not a great moment, but an interesting moment where Jill's apartment or her condo has been burglarized. She comes home and the door's ajar and she realizes stuff's missing. And she goes, oh no, because she kept it in a box in the attic. Did they come to get the box? And they hadn't. It was just a normal burglary. The box was still there. But then if you fast forward 40 years, the Mueller team did kind of the same thing, different technology. They made a point, and I talked to an FBI agent on the team and several prosecutors, of downloading and backing up their computer files to an offsite server located at a different government building because same exact concern. So, you know, it's these historical echoes do sound through the years.
Trump has had a few special counsels investigating him. One of them was Jack Smith.
Yeah.
You write that he never had a chance. Why is that?
Because he didn't have enough time. By the time Merrick Garland appointed him, it was November of 2022, leaving 2 years, almost exactly, to get a case in two cases, the classified documents.
Why did he take so long?
So this is a great question that's been roundly debated. I sort of proffer in the, but there were people out there in media saying, who were defending Garland for a while, saying, oh no, he's really just a stealth ninja. You just don't see it. But me and many other commentators who've been in DOJ said, no, we would know. We would see subpoenas. We would see, and we're seeing none of that. So I think we've been proven right on that. The why, this I would just have to speculate, informed speculation. He didn't want to tangle with Trump. He didn't think this would be good for the country, good for maybe the Democratic Party. And I think he was just hoping that he would be able to say someday, look, we follow the facts and the law. We got all the guys who stormed the Capitol and it never led directly to Trump. And that's how investigations go sometimes. But when Congress had those hearings, the January 6th hearings, I think it forced his hand. But by this point, it's 2 years later, there was never any way Jack Smith was going to be able to investigate, indict, deal with the immunity issue, which was definitely headed to the Supreme Court, and try these cases before 2 years, before the November 24 election. And sure enough, he did not get either of them in before the election. Trump wins, and that's the end.
There was also a special counsel appointed in the Hunter Biden case. What did Biden think of that decision on the part of Garland?
Not a fan. You know, initially, Biden kept up a good public face. He was sort of, you know, Biden, up until the end, was actually remarkably tolerant of special counsel. Like, he inherits John Durham, the guy who was investigating the Mueller team, and lets him finish out his work totally unimpeded. He ends up at one point with a special counsel investigating him, the president, right, Robert Hur, and his son, Hunter Biden. And the only things Biden ever said publicly were sort of like, I would say, exemplary to a point. He would say, you know, we're going to respect the independence of DOJ. And was asked several times, will you ever pardon your son? He said, absolutely not. Like, didn't even hedge. And then he pardons his son. And that changes everything. Undermines his legacy, because the way he pardoned his son, it's a you would think Trump issued that statement. He says, oh, it's political targeting and this and that. And then he pardons his siblings and in-laws. Also, there's reporting that I quote Bob Woodward, but Woodward reported in his book War that behind the scenes, Biden was fuming and was saying, I never should have appointed this guy and he's effed it all up, meaning Garland. So Biden put on a brave public face for a while, but I think those actions in the end game of the presidency really undermine Biden's legacy when it comes to DOJ.
Pam Bondi has fired prosecutors who have worked on the January 6th case.
Yeah.
You were a former career prosecutor yourself. What's your reaction when you see actions like that?
I mean, I think it's completely unacceptable. There's a line that's been crossed here, which is this. You can fire, if you're the president, I mean, look, legally, you can fire, I think, anyone in DOJ. But historically, it's always been observed that you can fire your political appointees, the people you've nominated who've been confirmed, AGs, deputy AG, solicitor general, and the U.S. attorneys, most importantly. However, the line is career prosecutors, what I was, people who are not political appointees. And it's not surprising they fired people who were on Jack Smith's team. I'm not saying I would have done that or I approve of it. But then they fired everyone who did these January 6th cases. A lot of these people were just assigned these. They're doing their jobs. And I say in the book, one of the things about the Trump administration is there's no pretext. They don't try to come up with cutesy reasons. They just say, you worked on a case against Donald Trump. That's why we're firing you. You worked on a January 6th case. You're out the door. And again, that plays into the title. When you come at the king, you better not miss. We have entered the retribution era of not just DOJ, but the White House.
How hard is it going to be for whoever the next president is to really restore this idea of an independent DOJ and a nonpartisan special counsel?
Very hard. I am not so Pollyanna-ish as to suggest that Donald Trump's going to have some awakening and suddenly say, you know, I think we ought to restore this independent function here. So the pitch at the end of the book is really aimed not at this current administration, but at the next one, the 48th president, whoever that may be, Republican or Democrat. And the argument I make is this, look, the book illustrates that the systems we've had have been highly imperfect. But, you know, to paraphrase Winston Churchill about democracy, it's the worst system except for all the others. And I argue in the book that we do need some independent means within DOJ to investigate the president and other very high-powered people, you know, high-powered cabinet officials. And we're better off with some rules than no rules at all, because when we have no rules, you end up in a Jim Comey 2016 scenario, which I argue in the book is the best example for why we can't just ad lib this, because you end up in a disaster like Comey created. So my pitch really is for good government. There's no self-interest to a president in having an independent counsel, right? I mean, as one of the people I interviewed said, everybody loves the idea of a special counsel until one's pointed at them. But I think our political body as a whole needs to restore this safeguard when the next president comes in.
I think Trump said, I'm so effed, right? When he found out that
was appointed. Yeah, he said, this is going to screw my presidency. I'm so effed when he found out about Mueller. But, you know, he'd apparently understood something about history. Yeah.
Last question. John Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh. Early cameos. They appear in your book, not only as Supreme Court justices, but also in their prior lives. So can you tell me more about that?
So John Roberts was one of the lawyers who was part of the team that drafted the regulations. There was 8 or 9 lawyers on this team, and I interviewed not John Roberts. I would love to. I should have asked. But a guy named Mark Toohey, and I said, this is when Roberts was just a judge, a regular appellate judge. I said, what was Roberts like? He said, I mean, and I think Toohey is pretty liberal. He said he was great. He said he was brilliant. Was very academic, you know, judgy minded, and was fair and was a really a good contributor to the team. Kavanaugh was a very young lawyer on Ken Starr's team. And he was seen as like, I think the lawyer I spoke with from Starr's team said he was the golden child. Like, even though he was fresh out of law school, Starr really turned to him and relied on him, especially for the legal issues. But, you know, Kavanaugh, on the one hand, when they questioned Clinton to his face, the same interview where the same grand jury testimony where Clinton says it depends on what the meaning of is, Kavanaugh wanted to confront him in front of the camera on, did you touch Monica here? Did she do this to you? You know, you can imagine. And Starr refused to do it. But then when it came time for the written report, which had all sorts of sexual detail, crashed the internet for the first time ever, Kavanaugh actually said, we should tone it down a little. There's too much in here, which I think ended up being, I'll tell you a funny moment from the book. So I asked Weisenberg, the prosecutor on that team, I said, you are well familiar with the criticism from Clinton's team, which will be reiterated in this book, that you all included prurient sexual detail way beyond what was necessary. What's your response? And I knew what Weisenberg's response would be. He was a great interviewer. He was very candid with me. He said, well, look, this was a perjury case. And so he was given a very specific definition. Perjury is if A touches B in these body parts, and we had to get specific. And I said, okay, but there's two parts in the report where you say that after Bill Clinton had had his encounter with Monica, pardon me, everybody, he masturbated into the private sink in the Oval Office. Did that have anything to do with perjury? And I mean, you know, how could that have had it? And Saul goes, yeah, maybe not that. That was probably too far. So I think it's the first time on record somebody on Starr's team has admitted they might have gone a bit too far. But, you know, I love that. I mean, look, people, I was surprised how many people were willing to speak to me. Everyone is on the record here. I have no anonymous. I wouldn't take people anonymously. There were some people who wanted to because people were willing, including recent people, people from Biden's team, Hunter Biden's team, Joe Biden's team, Trump's team, because I think they want to tell their piece for history. I think they understand that these lessons will last. And, you know, there's sometimes conflict. People disagree on who did the right thing. So I appreciated the willingness of all these folks to go on record and to be candid and honest.
You got so many amazing stories. The book is called When You Come at the King. You can buy it wherever you buy your books. Eli Honig, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. It was great.